Welcome to a Canucks game day. I am Vic Nazar. You're on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Yeah, Canucks Central, back. We do this on game days. A one-hour look at the matchup for the Vancouver Canucks. Today versus the Montreal Canadiens, 4:30 puck drop. So adjust your schedule. It's a little bit different than a 4 o'clock start. In Montreal, Batch and Hershey will have your call. Satyar Shah, Randeep Janda, Dan Riccio on the pregame show. And then myself and Sat all throughout the course of the game and postgame, which features Ian McIntyre as well. And, of course, your reaction, 650 into the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. If you want to say anything, send it in to the Smart Alternative. Visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. We'll bring in a special guest for these Canucks Central game days. And with me today is Mike Santorelli, longtime NHLer and former Vancouver Canuck. Also standing here from the Canucks Hour, Jamie Dodd, who, again, Monday to Friday on Sportsnet 650 with the Canucks Hour. The Vancouver Canucks pick up a couple of more L's over the weekend. 4-2 versus Columbus, 3-2 versus Boston yesterday. Santo, at least they didn't give up a an empty net goal.
Yeah, exactly.
it's the one positive we can take away.
Well, that's what you got to do in these times. You got to look for the positives and what you could take out of each game, right?
It's it is so tough right now, and I think it gets highlighted yesterday by Elias Pettersson. I think that's, you know, again, we're specifically going to talk about the hockey component of what's going on the club, right? There's bigger picture things, Jim Benning, Travis Green, all that stuff is important. But from a player's perspective and on the ice level, like there was a lot of things to be concerned about, obviously how this season has gone. Elias Pettersson finds himself playing 8 minutes and 23 seconds on even strength, which is real bad. 5-on-5, I believe he was the lowest out of everyone. Even strength, again, he played 4 more seconds than Justin Dowling. It's a real concern. Now, I think we all recognize the talent, even some people that were detractors when he was drafted. You know, he's put up points in this league. He's a star-level player. To what level, we can have that conversation. But right now, you know, he's low on confidence. Things are cratering around him, and things are cratering with him. And I want to bring this up because he's mentioned this before about the wrist. Hey, it's not an issue. Obviously, it is physically healed. But there is a mental component to recovery as well. I want to bring you in on this specifically, but like, did you go through any big injuries at all?
Yeah, there were a few injuries during my time in Florida, and they were at different times, different points throughout the year, and I could get into it. That particular injury happened right in training camp, and
right.
It wasn't as severe as the one that I sustained in Vancouver, but I was out about 4 or 5 weeks. I think I rushed myself back. But for me, it's that injury was harder for me to come back to compared to my 6 months season-ending injury because I needed surgery. And the reason why I say that is just because you miss training camp. Okay, you spend all summer, your off season, 4 or 5 months in the off season, getting ready, getting to go to the for the upcoming season, and then you're out 4 weeks and sustain an injury in preseason is pretty tough, you know, to come back to. You know, we talked about missing training camp, and then you're playing catch up, right? And then you come back and maybe you're not up to speed and you're not producing at the level that you want to or the level for Pettersson as he should and as he's expected to, and then it just weighs on you, and then from there it just snowballs, and then it's just harder to get out of it, and then you try forcing things, and it's just for me it was tougher to come out of that injury than whereas an injury I sustained and I was out for 6 months, had shoulder surgery, but at least that gave me those 6 months to prepare for the upcoming season,
right?
You know, and then go through a full training camp, go through a full exhibition season, and then I found, you know, for me anyhow, that was a bit easier for me.
Is there a component to this of like trusting your body all over again as well? Because yeah, I imagine like, you know, the first big injury you go through, it's all right. Well, now what can I do with my wrist, and how do you get through all of that?
You know, I think maybe a bit. For me personally, I think once that for me, once that puck drops, everything kind of just clears your mind and you're just ready to go and you want to do whatever you can on that ice to succeed and play the right way. Maybe like in between you know, off days, you think about it because you kind of get some lingering effects that post-surgery or post-injury.
Right.
But once that puck drops, I mean, everything kind of clears your mind, and there's really only one thing that matters.
Because the reason I bring this up, Jamie, and Jamie Dodd joining us here as well from the Canucks Hour, is, you know, physically, I think we look at Elias Pettersson and say, yeah, fine. He's moving his feet. Well, we've seen some of the player tracking data, and it's still like, hey, mid-20s, miles per hour, he's still flying about, he can still get to his certain speeds. And we've talked about, hey, the confidence of this is what's hampering him. So you go through the mental aspect of everything, and people have mentioned, hey, the wrist injury, it's its own issue. But this looks more mental than anything, confidence. And that process of coming back from your first big injury, like I'm curious how much, if that plays a role in any of this at all, but you know, so much of what we're seeing from him is mental more so than physical.
It certainly seems like that, right? Because we've seen, how many plays have we seen where the puck slips off his stick, right? Where normally we're used to him, you know, it's glued to his stick and he's shaking defenders and he's breaking their ankles. We've seen that so sparingly. And instead we've seen the opposite, where simple plays, he's not able to make them as consistently as he should be, right? And so it's hard to escape the conclusion that whether it's confidence, whether he doesn't have certain trust in his abilities anymore, whatever it is, it does seem to be mental. And that's such a difficult spot to be in, because obviously it's hard to rebuild your confidence when you're not performing, but then you just look at the whole situation around him and the team isn't performing at all whatsoever right now. There's nothing, you know, it's not even as if the, you know, okay, I'm not getting it done, but my winger's playing really well right now and he can set me up for a tap-in goal. Like, that's not coming because nobody's playing that well right now. So he's in a really tough spot to try to rebuild his confidence.
And, you know, Santa, when you see just his deployment, because we're talking about, hey, rebuilding your confidence, after you see what happened last night, again, 8 minutes, 23 seconds on even strength, is that a confidence-building move? Or, you know, how do you make that next step to building out his confidence or just improving the mental aspect of his game?
Yeah, I think, obviously, it's not going to help your confidence, for sure. But, you know, we talked about him still being a young player in the league and having to go through growing pains, and this is just something that he's going to come out of. And in the NHL, you got to learn how to produce, you know, at times in limited minutes. Like, whatever you get, you got to find a way, you know, to produce offensively. And you know, there's guys around the league, there are guys that have done a good job of sticking in the league because they are able to provide, you know, offense in those limited minutes at times. And then once you do, then you get that increased ice time and more shifts, more rope, more of a leash to try to create more offense.
Because you look at last night's performance and, you know, they lose 3-2. And I'm honestly, it's hard to separate, like, what good performances look like for the Vancouver Canucks right now, because everything ends up with 0 points, and the season is spiraling out of control. They're on pace for 49 points now, which is unbelievable to think of. And, you know, yesterday, okay, they get the first goal. They have a lead later on in the game, into the third period. And, okay, that's all well and good, and yet they get completely sunk on the penalty kill. And this has been the problem all season long. We've talked about it briefly. Why is this penalty kill so bad, Mike? I think there's a grander way to look at it and be like, oh, the defensive rotations and all that sort of stuff. But like, why is it this bad?
Well, I think first, when you take penalties of that nature, it's especially late in the game, it's just a recipe kind of for disaster.
Sure.
You know, you hear coaches say all the time, they get frustrated when players take, you know, penalties, coming back into your own end and out of the offensive zone. So like those penalties are the hard ones to kill. So you're kind of already behind the eight ball there. But for me, what I've just seen throughout the year is just that, and maybe more so now, is just they look to be tentative out there, right? And just nervous to make a mistake. At times they're in the right positioning, but you know they're a little bit unsure and unable to just go out there and just play, and that goes just because of the way things are going right now, right? Other things I just see is that at times that it's the quick puck movement that gets them, because they're at times the penalty kill is just way too spread out. A term we use when on the penalty kill when you're doing your pre-scout is that if you got to recognize the pressure moments when the pucks are on loose pucks, when pucks are on the boards. If one go, all got to go. You can't just see one guy going and the other three just watching. So that's kind of how you get spread out, and that's what teams do to exploit that. And at other times, I see guys extending their shifts on the penalty kill, and they're trying to play right. Goalie. I mean, you can't play goalie out there because there's two guys in the middle in the PK, and you got to be able to keep their power play on the outside and onto one side.
Well, and as you said, trying to play goalie on the Marchand goal, right, where it looked like it might have gone in last night, but then the puck is just kind of loose in front of the net, and all four Canucks penalty killers collapse to the front of the net, but they're not paying attention to the puck, and Marchand is just able to scoop it up and put it in the net. And to me, just watching that kind of speaks to, you know, as you're saying, a lack of confidence and not being on the same page, right? You're all trying to make the desperation play to get in front of the net and play goalie, but, you know, somebody's got to be on the puck in that instance as well.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And even on the other goal, on the winning goal, right? I think they're in the spots, but you know, the puck goes through, and at that time you got to do whatever it takes to tie up that stick or get in front of that stick so that puck doesn't go through. And at that point in the game, I mean, you kind of got to go a little old school there and do whatever it takes just to clear that net.
So the other thing that's kind of concerning to me as well, and we've talked about this in seasons past too, Travis Green has mentioned this, of, you know, when they play strong teams, you know, there's going to be moments in games where, hey, you start out and then either you start out hot or you grow into the game and you continue to raise your level. I think one thing that stood out to me yesterday is, and we see this versus Colorado this season, Boston raised their game. At some point, they just raised their game, and Vancouver was not going to compete. I guess I'll pose this to you this way. What do you see when those moments happen? But also, like, what is that like when it happens in the moment? Like, can you feel it's like, okay, these guys are starting to get going. Now, what do we have to do to adapt and evolve into this particular game?
Yeah, I just think, like, as right now, the way the season has gone, that plays a big factor. And I think for me, what I see is that, you know, the effort was there last night, right? I think just because of the losses have been accumulating and they're fragile, that when they feel that wave of pressure from the opposing team, they just like the penalty kill, they try to kind of, you try to play safe. And early in your career, you learn that you can't play safe, because, you know, a saying that we like to use, that safe is death, right? So you just see that lack of confidence, and when you see players playing safe, it's just that they have a tendency of watching the game, and the reaction isn't there, right? You're not moving your feet, you're playing nervous, and that's when bad things happen. And experienced teams, they recognize that, and they quickly rectify that. And to rectify something like that, just by, you know, even one player, a block shot rectifies that, or just playing, simplifying in that particular moment, getting an offensive zone shift for 30, 40 seconds in their end, just to create the momentum. But it's just about recognizing how to shift that momentum into a positive way.
So, okay. Playing it safe is a great term for this, because I think one of the things we see in the offensive zone is not enough offensive creativity. Too often it's just shooting the puck for the sake of shooting the puck, and yeah, the puck ends up in and around dirty areas and trying to create those second or third chances. Are you set up to create those second and third chances? So why does this team struggle to get chances outside of just rebounds and tip-ins? Because there is a difference between shots and chances. This team is
bad at creating chances. They're fine at generating shots, but they are bad at creating chances. If you go back versus Columbus, they directed a lot of rubber at the net, 41 shots on goal, and a lot more attempts as well. But there wasn't a lot of chances in relation to how much they quote-unquote dominated the puck relative to Columbus also creating. Why is it such a struggle for this team to create chances?
A few reasons. I think you need to be able, successful teams offensively need to have different multiple attack options. Are you able to, and you have to be able to adjust to certain teams that you're playing, right? For example, Pittsburgh's a run and gun team. Like, are you a team that can create offense off the rush? Or when you go into Columbus and you play Columbus, you know it's going to be a hard fought game. Are you able to create offense in the offensive zone by holding on to pucks and twisting, turning, and finally taking pucks to the middle of the ice? And another thing I had was just the kind of the chemistry there, right? And in order to do those items, the line combinations have to have that makeup. And for me, it's just the reason why I think the lack of chances, we haven't seen a ton of chances. There's not much team speed or high-end elite skill to make those little plays to find the middle of the ice, the lack of depth. And maybe that's just right at this particular moment, because we've seen it in the past that the players have those abilities to do so. Pedersen has the ability to do so. Höglander has the ability to do so. And now it's just being able to do it on a consistent basis.
And Mike, you mentioned chemistry there, right? And the line combinations have to have some element of chemistry. And we hear from fans and listeners all the time that are frustrated that Travis Green has switched his line combinations up so much this year. Now, I do understand it, right? Because pretty much any groupings he's tried, they haven't had success. And he's always looking, okay, well, what is the group I can put together that will figure out a way to create offense consistently? So I do understand it. But from your perspective as a player, how did you feel when it felt like the lines were constantly in a blender and you didn't have that certainty? Okay, I'm going to be playing with this guy, for at least the next couple of weeks here.
Yeah, it was obviously tough, but I mean, as a coach at a much lower level, you look down the bench and you try to see who's going, and you try to tinker here and there on what you can do. And he's at right now they're struggling to score, and rightfully so. Like, he's trying to find and push buttons in order to create and generate some type of offense. But to answer your question, as a player, I mean, when you get the tap to go on the ice, you want to do whatever you can to help produce and help your team out.
You mentioned a couple of teams earlier, Pittsburgh being one. Is there a style that you think would suit this team for what they can do, either in the here and now, or I think the better question might be long term, because this season is getting to a stage where it's lost. You're just trying to salvage and build towards what might be in the future. Is there a style that you say, hey, when I look at the talent that's available on this team, and obviously there can be changeover, trades that might just happen, JT Miller might not be here in 2 years, Bo Horvat might not be here in 2 years, all this sort of stuff. If you were trying to develop a style of play from this point moving forward as the new identity of the Vancouver Canucks, is there a style that you think suits this group?
Yeah, well, I think moving forward, like, you look at the teams that have been winning and have been top teams in the league year in, year out, and they have, when I say multiple layers of attack, if you use Chicago, for example, you have the Kane line that can produce offense. Their biggest producer of offense is off the rush. But then when you have Taze and Hossa and Brennan Saad back a few years ago, their ability to wear teams down in the offensive zone, have those 45-second shifts, and ultimately get pucks and get to the net, taking pucks to the middle of the ice, was extremely effective. So they have different looks. You look at Edmonton right now, in the last couple of years, they haven't had the success they've wanted, but they're more of a rush offense style team. So what do? They go out and they get Zach Hyman. They get some bigger players. Puljujarvi's coming along now. And now they have a second look of attack. So when they play other teams that maybe like a Columbus style or they're able to still produce offense. So for me, to answer your question, Bick, is that you need a makeup of players that can obviously play together, but provide offense different in different ways.
So what pieces do you feel like they have so far? If we're talking about, hey, they're the rush component to this roster, what pieces do you feel that they have to do that moving forward?
Well, I think, you know, Pettersson will be back. He'll get back to his normal form. So he has the ability to take over games himself. Like, we know his skill level. For me, it's just more speed. Like, look what Connor Garland's been doing on the ice right now. It's been fantastic. When Hoglander's going, it's fantastic. More team speed, ability to come out of those corners with speed. And then when you see a hole, drive the net and take pucks and do whatever you're going to do to get that puck in the net. It's more of that. It's more of, you know, you see some at times where Tanner Pearson is effective and he's able to shield off pucks in the offensive zone and then get off the wall and take it to the net. And now it's just being able to do that and on more of a consistent basis, and players that can do that on more of a consistent basis.
So we're looking at what these next 60 games might be. And look, like, that makes all the sense in the world, Mike. Like, I totally understand what you're talking about, hey, being more consistent and developing those traits. And yet, look, you've got 60 games to go here, and there's players that are going to be worried about themselves to some degree. And, you know, how do you not lose perspective of what this season becomes and kind of playing for yourself? Because, you know, look, if I'm JT Miller, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, hey, as much as I want to play in a team structure and I'm worried about, you know, wins and losses and all that sort of stuff, I still have to look out for myself and what is the remaining 60 games going to look at? And I'm just using a name, not singling out JT Miller or anything like here, but I imagine in this environment you get a bunch of players that are going to deviate a bit from the team game.
Yeah, there's that. That's a fine line there too. But like, as Garland said last night in his post game, is, you know, there's 60 games, still a lot of hockey to be played, and you know, you haven't really been identified as being a team that's out of the race mathematically or anything like that. But yeah, in situations where, you know, you find yourself on the you know, the season's kind of getting away from you, players are playing for jobs, right? They're playing to establish themselves in the league. For a younger guy, you know, guys that are veteran guys, they're playing to, you know, possibly be that piece that other teams are looking to acquire to put them over the hump, you know, to be a contending Stanley Cup team. So this it's items like that.
Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd here on Canucks Central with Mike Santorelli, setting up a Canucks game at 4:30 this evening versus the Montreal Canadiens. Batch and Hershey will have your call. Sat Dan Randeep, your pregame show, and myself and Satyr Shah throughout the course of the game and into the evening all the way through till 9 o'clock tonight as part of your postgame show, which you can always interact in 6:50, 6:50 later on tonight. We'll head to break, and we'll be back in a bit here on Canucks Central on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. What is up? Welcome back to Canucks Central on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Yeah, we do it on game days, noon to 1, here on 650. I'm Bick Nizar. With me today is co-host of the Canucks Hour, Jamie Dodd, and also a longtime NHLer and former Vancouver Canuck, Mike Santorelli. You can always check him out, santorellihockey.ca. Before we get back to some of the hockey stuff and your thoughts, if you have any questions for Mike, 650, 650 into the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox about the game tonight or just the Canucks season on a whole on improving where they are right now. Some breaking news in the world of baseball here. Robbie Ray, spent a season with the Jays, had some success, has signed a five-year deal, or is finalizing a five-year deal worth $115 million with the Seattle Mariners. So if you're a regional Jays-Mariners fan, I guess you're happy.
You get to keep cheering for the tight pants. Right? And let's be clear, Robbie Ray didn't just have some success. He won the Cy Young.
Yeah, no, he was
year.
Awesome.
He was fantastic.
And let's be clear, those weren't just tight pants. Those were the tightest pants anyone's ever seen.
So big payday for Robbie Ray. And again, some breaking news there. A report from Jeff Passan. 5 years, $115 million. Santo, that's some big money. Don't you wish you played baseball?
I want to see how much money he puts on the board after first game back. I wonder if they do that in baseball.
That must just be an athlete thing. Come on, it must be a thing.
I would think.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, I think so.
What were your big money on the board games?
Definitely here in Vancouver. Signing actually after my first entry level deal. Every time you come to Vancouver, you got to put money on the board because it's your hometown team, right?
Who were the guys that were notorious of, like, you look up at the board and you're like, oh, he's putting that much up? If you're comfortable saying.
Well, David Booth was the guy that was always made sure that you didn't get away with anything. You know, some guys try to get away with not having to put up money on the board, but he would he'd catch you all the time.
Just to make sure everyone's chipping in?
Yeah, exactly. To make sure he was able to get every penny's worth when he put up money on the board.
Pick Nazar, Jamie Dodd, and Mike Santarelli here. So we're just kind of talking there before we went to break of, you know, not losing perspective of what the season is. You still have to develop good traits. There are players on this team that have to continue to develop. I would say the team as a whole, a lot of players need to continue to get better. Two guys I do look at is Podkolzin and Hoglander. They're still young, impressionable players into this league. What do they take away from this season? Because I think a lot of fans would look at both of these players, maybe Hoglander in particular so far this year has been, oh, he's been phenomenal. He has been full value for how he is doing his growth. But now you're going to be playing in an environment that already is chaotic and might sink even more further into chaos this season. What do they take away from this year?
I think for me, we've already kind of touched on it, but it's just that consistency. It's being able to produce at a high level, you know, year in, year out, game in, game out. I know earlier in my career, you know, just kind of going through the minors, you know, a coach always said to me, you know, one game doesn't make a career, or 1 year doesn't make a career. So it's definitely, you know, the consistency. Another thing for me is with those two, they've had some success early on. It's just continuing to evolve your game, adding layers to your game. And what I mean by that is, you know, a Hoglander, you know, he's effective. He uses his speed well. Now, is there an opportunity for him to be an effective penalty killer down the line? He has the speed to do so. He works hard. So it's being able to take your game to another level and another dimension.
The phrase I've always heard is, you know, when you're a young player, you're just trying to get to the league, and then you're trying to survive in the league. Hoglander is at a stage where, look, he's in the NHL, and now he's surviving, and now let's go get paid in the league. You know, where is he in that stage where you look at and say, you know, he's going to be up for a contract in a year and a half? Where is he in that stage of what level he looks like he's ready to play at? Is it third liner, like a good to great third liner, or just kind of been a second liner for him?
Yeah, it depends. You know, for him, if he's a real good third liner for the Vancouver Canucks, then that means they're going to have a very good team,
yeah.
Right? So, and then you have a lot of team depth, and when guys do go in slumps like they are right now, you're able to kind of, you know, move pieces around on your team, and just gives the Canucks more ways to attack you in different when guys are going right.
And for Podkolzin as well, again, rookie year, it's just figuring out the league, and, you know, he's made it, and now it's about surviving and thriving. Does he have a different upside to his game than Hoglander? Because, maybe it's just because of the size or something like that. Is there more wrinkles to his game that you've seen in the early returns?
Yeah, he's a big, strong kid, and you know, he has an incredible shot. Maybe more of a you know, a scoring threat than you know, Hoglander. But with him too, right? I think you know, he's having some success. It's about continuing that. Your second year is always the hardest, right? We've heard many times the sophomore slump. So it's just making sure that you're learning the league. You're developing good habits. You're becoming a professional. You know, and then just taking it into next year and going from there.
Bick Nizar and Mike Santorelli here. We'll try to get to a few of your questions. Keep texting them in 650-650. Some are coming into the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. The smart alternative is at Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. You mentioned you know, ways that they can create offense, and you know, Taze5 on Twitter here texts in or tweets us. You know, we're just talking about, you know, different machinations of how to create offense. He was saying, hey, they don't get to the dirty area. One guy that does is Connor Garland, and you know, he does it maybe in a different fashion. How is he a creating offense? And when you start putting guys around him to play to his style, you know, we've kind of done this of, hey, Patterson's there, Horvat's there, you know, what suits him best? Because yesterday he does a little bit differently. He does it with the shot, and I'm stunned how much force he generated on that one that gets called back with a short stick. But you know, he just creates offense in so many different ways.
Yeah, for me, it's a speed. Like, you know, he looks good on that half wall in the power play. Like, you see how he comes off the wall with a ton of speed and attacks down the flank and gets a good hard shot off. But he's also doing that in tighter areas in the offensive zone, being able to hold on to pucks, twisting and turning. And once he beats defenders with his speed, and once he sees an opening, he's not scared to get to those dirty areas and take the puck to the nets. And I think that's why he's having successes. And another reason is he's tenacious. He wants that puck all the time. He's never out of a play. He'll be on his knees, and he'll still find a way to find that puck and try to make something happen with it.
He manages to avoid contact really well. Like, even when he gets in tight to other players, where do you think that comes from? Is it just, hey, a guy who's always had to fight for things, or is it a mentality?
He's just super evasive. I mean, some guys have it, right? He's just super quick, able to, you know, slip away from checks, and and one skill that I'd like to highlight there too is the ability to, like, recognize when you have defenders beat and their foot positioning, right? Like, if he does such a good job of twisting and turning and then taking pucks to the net, like we already discussed, but in order to do that, you got to understand. Did the defender cross his feet over it? Okay, now I could go back this way and take and use him to expose him in this particular way, and he does an effective job at that.
So there's a big difference, or so I suppose an evolution for a player that you know, recognizes, hey, here's what I'm able to do, and then how do I attack another player's limitations?
Yeah, I think. Bick, you're asking how they...
For a player to recognize that in real time, to say, hey, like, if I'm thinking as Connor Garland, there's things I'm capable of. And then you mentioned, hey, how he attacks guys with their bad foot positioning, and it's adapting to the move that you're trying to make, or the skill or off-the-rush opportunity you're trying to create off of a defender and how he's defending you.
Yeah, well, when you go into a battle with a player, or you're trying to beat a player, you have something in your mind what you're trying to do, and then it's his ability to react within those moves that has been exceptional, right? And the elite players have those abilities to do so. It's not kind of a set in stone thing where I'm going to do this particular move and it's going to work. It's being able to read and react, and that's what the game of hockey is all about. Being able to read and react, and the ones that are able to do so as quick as possible are the ones that are effective.
When we're looking at players here, and Jamie, I'll pose this to you as well. You and I have done this exercise already in the past, looking at next season and just beyond. How many players are kind of solutions moving forward? And it's more so just about, hey, you know, if Brock Besser was a second line player, okay, that's a solution. But yeah. Right now, he's you kind of need him to be a first-line player and score goals, and he's not doing either right now. But in their slated roles, like how many players are solutions moving forward?
Well, I think it can be a lot. Because a big part of the story of this season is that guys aren't performing to their capabilities, right? So, I looked at the forward group in particular coming into the year and thought, okay, that's a really legit top nine forward group. And I still think it can be, right? I don't look at those guys. And, obviously, Garland's playing well, Podkolzin's playing well, Hoglander's playing well. So there are some people who are getting the job done. But the people we would point to and say they're struggling, Besser, Pettersson, Horvat, I still think they can have success in these roles, right? I'm not ready to say, okay, Bo Horvat, he can't be a second-line center on a good team. I don't think that's the case at all. I think he absolutely can be. Same with Brock Besser. I think he can be a top-six threat on a good team. Elias Pettersson. So that's kind of what makes it so hard is you can't look at these, first 20-odd games and say, okay, we know definitively that Elias Pettersson can't be the first-line center on a good team. I don't think we do know that. I still think that's very much a possibility.
Is that a weird conversation, Mike, to say, specifically, can this guy be a first-line center on a winning team? Or do you look at it and just say, hey, right now this team, like where they are right now, just get good players. Just get good players and we'll solve it as we go ahead moving forward. If I were to ask you how many players are solutions moving forward, how many would you say here?
Yeah, well, the core young guys. I think you've invested into those players. I don't think, like Jamie said, the 20 games into the year, you kind of don't want to blow things up or anything like that, but you got to see things out. I guess the tricky part is that they're getting paid pretty good salaries,
yeah.
and you're against the cap, and when their salaries come up, they're obviously restricted and they're due for a certain raise, right? So can you continue affording those type of players if they don't produce? And if they don't produce, is your return going to be good enough to, part ways?
Yeah, right now, the big problem right now in the here and now is the return on investment on some of these players is staggeringly low. It's Pettersson not producing. It's Besser not producing. And, a lot of focus gets shifted onto these guys, which is why the inbox has been full the last 24 hours, 48 hours, all weekend long over here we go again with Elias Pettersson. It's just not clicking at all right now, Jamie.
Well, and not only that, there was a moment maybe in that last homestand where you could kind of squint and say, okay, maybe it's starting to come around a little bit. The on-ice results look a little better. If he gets some bounces to go his way, we'll start to see the old Elias Pettersson again sometime soon if you were trying to be optimistic. But it's going backwards now, right? I mean, he's the fewest 5-on-5 minutes on the team last night. That's crazy. He wasn't out there in the key situation late in the game when they're trying to tie the game up. So it's not only is he not producing, you're not even seeing the signs that he's about to break out of the slump or that he's about to turn it around. It's going in the wrong direction, which is the really shocking thing to me at the moment.
Mike, I asked you earlier about, hey, is this a move that you can see, building back his confidence, or how do you start building back his confidence? Did you like that move in general, just to, sink his minutes that way?
Yeah, it happened in Pittsburgh as well, but, it's a result-based league, and if you're not producing, then, then they're going to find someone else, right? But at the same time, in his defense, in Pettersson's defense, there's other guys that are getting put out there that are struggling just as much and aren't involved in the way I think they should be, and they're out there. So, maybe other guys need to have that type of treatment as well.
How long do you think you can keep doing this? It's tough right now because it does feel like there's no good answers to this scenario. It feels like we're going to trend towards an eventual conclusion of Travis Green not coaching this team anymore. And is this like your final hurrah of, in theory, this is what's best for the team to win 2 points now? Is this what's best for the team long term to kind of keep doing this Elias Pettersson thing of 8 minutes of ice time at even strength? That it's conflicting thoughts at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's on one side of it, I think, you keep giving him the ice and keep trying to have him try to figure it out, but when the results are the same, or you see the same mistakes, or you see the same forcing of plays, and It's tough to just continue to give a player those same minutes and whatnot. But it definitely is a fine line. Like he's a player that you got to build this franchise around, and you know, like you're absolutely right. Maybe there's some leeway there that now, hey, like you've kind of reached this point. Maybe it's, you know, give him a little more just to start you know, gaining that confidence back. But as a player too, you got to be able to fight through these hard times. Like we talked about before, like. You know, playing in the league is like a roller coaster, never too high, never too low, and you're gonna go through ups and downs in your career, and it's how you come out of those lows. For me,
Vic Nazar and Jamie Dodd here, also with Mike Santorelli on Canucks Central on game days. Another incident. We'll tee up again with Montreal tonight, but another incident from yesterday. Brad Marchand, he will have a hearing today for his slew foot on Oliver Ekman and Larson. We've started to kind of see this a lot, Santo, or kneeing plays and slew foots. And Elliot Friedman kind of mentioned this last week on the 32 Thoughts podcast of we're seeing more of these. And I'm curious if this is a result of the cross-checking emphasis, if players are finding new ways to, you know, either create contact or just they're so wary of getting cross-check penalties, it's manifesting in other actions. And we're seeing these slew foots come to rise up in a bit more frequency. Do you see that? And what did you make of that slew foot last night?
Yeah, you know, with Brad Marchand, he's always trying to get under your skin, right? I mean, you know, I'm not going to defend him or whatnot, but he's a great player. I think for me, maybe just overall, I'll touch on that. Like, I think as a player in that particular moment, there's that fine line because, you know, you want to finish your check. You want to separate the man from the puck to obviously cause a turnover, but another reason why you want to be able to finish your check is to make that player irrelevant. Because if you don't finish your check in certain areas, that player is gonna go by you, and then he's back in the play. So you gotta close in on those guys. But in those particular times when players are turning the back, maybe they're trying to help those type of players, trying to embrace the hit. It doesn't look as bad. And then at times, you know, I guess they kind of get their feet kind of get mixed up, right?
Is that cross-checking emphasis kind of a byproduct of all this? And, you know, like, what do you make of the cross-check penalty call so far this year?
Yeah, I think with the cross check, like you obviously as soon as the referee sees that motion, you know he's gonna call it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know you don't want to do that. You want to find other ways in order to be effective separating the man from the puck. And obviously, you know, I just think it's a dirty play. Like, you don't want to slew foot guys. Like, it causes injuries and you know it's not needed. I just thought maybe that could be a reason, just trying to help the player brace the hit. What kind of leads to sometimes their feet going through and kind of causing the slew foot.
Game tonight at 4:30. It's going to be the third game in four nights with travel on top of it. How did you manage your energy in spots like this? And is there things you can do before the game outside of just, you know, during the game? You obviously might want to manage your energy, but what did you do before the game to try to get ready for a third game in four nights?
Yeah, well, preparation is huge, right? Like, even leading up to the to the road trip and to those particular points in the season, it's what you do then. Like, are you taking with your off ice workouts? Are you preparing? Are you getting your body ready? Whether you're needing any type of physio or massage therapy or you know, cold tubs or whatnot, just to make sure you're ready to go. It's your fluid intake. It's your getting good meals in. It's your recovery after games and your preparation. Before games, right? Your pregame warm-up, but also it's in the style of the game that you want to play too. Like, you don't want to be out there extending your shifts. You don't, mm-hmm. don't want to be forcing plays. And also it's the team play, right? And that's why we always say on the road, it's just, you want to get an ugly road win, because it really is like you're playing so many games in such a short period that, you know, you need to find a way to win, and to do so, you might have to find ugly ways to do so.
During the game, is that the big point of emphasis of, hey, shift length, just do your 40 and focus on when you need to get back?
Yeah, you don't want to extend your shifts, especially like in those long change periods. You don't want to get caught out there because, you know, then you can't get off, and other guys are sitting there, and the line combinations are all messed up. But yeah, for me, shift length is hard, is big, and then also not, you know, not forcing plays. Let plays develop. Let them open up, and then create your opportunity that way.
A couple of thoughts coming into the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. If you got a last-minute question here, we'll pitch it by Santo. People want to know, Mike, you played with Kevin Bieksa. Do you think he'd make a good coach? Or just maybe not necessarily here next week or something like that if a change happens, just in general on Bieksa.
Ron McLean started that one on Saturday night, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I saw that. It was funny. I loved his response too, but you know, he's awesome. I think he's a really good leader. He's a guy that understands the game so well. Both sides of it. I'm unsure if that's a direction he'd like to go. He's doing a pretty good job right now on Hockey Night in Canada, so I don't know if he'd want to give up that that gig, but yeah, we'd have to see if he wants to take that route in his next career.
Jeff Remission is kind of worried about the you know, large, big scale picture of what's going on and how this organization is kind of going through some of the processes right now with the coach and management and all that sort of stuff. But he's worried about free agents kind of being drawn to this organization. If this continues to play out this way, do players keep an eye on the situation that's happening here, Mike, or is it just, hey, if a contract comes about, that's the place I'll go?
Sorry, his question is about free agents, just signing free agents.
Yeah, and you know, realistically, like how aware and how focused are you on how an organization goes about their business?
Obviously, you know, you kind of want to build through the draft and build within. I think teams that do so have some real good success. But teams have their pro scouts and they have their amateur scouts and you know, they identify certain needs that their team or wants that their teams need, right? And they're going about that it that way. And possibly with the Canucks, you know, dating back to how this season, before this season, you know, they knew they were in a predicament with their cap issue. So they, you know, previously with their pro scouts, they're probably going out to see where can I find value for our bucks and find players that are on favorable contract that can help round out our roster and be competitive. And I, guys like Burrows and Hunt and Dowling. So it's kind of like that aspect of it.
I think Jeff is asking though, but like as a player, would you be alarmed at how the organization is going about some of their business as far as like they're leaving?
Sorry.
Yeah. They're leaving Jim Banning out here to dry. They're leaving Travis Green out here to dry. Would you be a bit worried as a player saying, hey, what's really happening in this organization?
Yeah, I think so. I think, but you want to control what you can control. Like as a player, your job is just to go out there and do what you do best on the ice. Why did they bring you here? They brought you on this team to fill this particular role. And as a player, that's what your main, that's what your focus is on, not the kind of the business ops or what's going on. Like you can only really control what you can.
Santo, always appreciate it, man. We rattle through another hour here, and we got a couple more games this week, so I'm sure we'll hear from you soon.
Okay, thanks for having me, guys.
That is Mike Santorelli here on Canucks Central, Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd, on a Canucks game day, 4:30 puck drop, Batch and Hershey. Your pregame show, Sat, Dan, Randeep, coming up shortly. Dan and Randeep on the People Show, up next here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.